Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello and welcome to an hour of mind power. Well, today we're going to be spacey, yes, but not in the way that that particular word might come into your mind with a certain image. We're going to be talking about UFOs, and I know there may be some people out there that think they're a little bit a space cadet mentality, but the truth is it's fascinating phenomena. It is a reality. So we're going to be talking with a gentleman, Mr. Kevin Randall, who has written all kinds of books, but UFOs especially are intriguing to him, and his book is called Crash, When UFOs Fall from the Sky. And this is sort of like a history book that we have in front of us. Kevin, I want to welcome you to the show.
Well, thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Well, it's a delight having you. Now, you're a retired lieutenant colonel. You've been investigating UFO sightings for, my gracious, well over 30 years, and you've written all kinds of books, you've lectured, you've been on programs throughout the country, and you have your own blog, and we'll give out information about that later on. But Kevin, your background fascinated me because you got a degree. I just love this kind of information about people. You got a degree in anthropology. You also did graduate work in journalism, psychology, and military science at the University of Iowa, the California Coast University, and the American Military University. You have master and doctoral degrees in psychology and a second master degree in the art of military science. And I'm just thinking about that. My goodness, you were in school for a lot of years. But what was the trigger that got you into being interested enough to investigate UFOs? I mean, anthropology, I can understand. There's some fascinating information that's been dug up regarding flying saucers. In fact, in your book, in one of your very first sentences, there are some people that said the first UFO crash came more than 12,000 years ago in China. Tell us how you got into this.
You boggle my mind here because you go through all of that, and then you want to know how I got into it, so now I have to go back to when I was a teenager in high school and blame my mother for this whole thing.
Okay. Wait a minute. Don't blame moms.
But yes, it's all mom's fault because mom was interested in science fiction. And science fiction, of course, is about alien visitation, interstellar flight, civilizations on other worlds, so it's not a big step from science fiction into UFOs because we're talking about interstellar space travel and civilizations on other worlds. So she kind of sparked my interest in UFOs, and I just picked up the ball there and ran with it. I ended up doing an awful lot of work looking at UFOs. So all of my interest in UFOs kind of preceded both my military and college careers.
Well, what, you know, we all can have say we have an interest. I mean, there's this intriguing thing. Maybe some people watch your television shows and go, yeah. But did you actually have a personal experience with this? And if so, when?
I usually say no, because my UFO sighting is really, really crummy. But I was a member of the Denver UFO Society back before they got real New Agey on it.
Mm-hmm.
And with a friend of mine, Eric Novotny, and we had gone out to one of the ranches south of Denver in the Castle Rock area for some kind of an outing. And we were sitting around the campfire, and we saw something moving across the sky from north to south. And at that time, there wasn't a whole lot of satellites up there, and I don't believe there were any any kind of polar trajectories at the time. But we watched the light cross from the horizon to horizon, and when it got directly overhead, it flashed once brightly and then moved off. Well, that's not much of a UFO sighting.
Mm-hmm.
Just a light in the sky. But that really came about. The only reason I had that sighting was simply because I had an interest in UFOs, and we were out at this outing on a ranch south of Denver. So That really didn't do it for me. But one of the things it did, one of my friends in high school's mother had seen a UFO.
Mm-hmm.
And the question I always had, because you read a lot of this stuff, and it's about something hazy seen in the distance, and you look at the photographs, and they're an awful lot of indistinct blobs of light in the sky. And so my friend's mother said she talked to me about her UFO sighting, and the first question I asked her was, well, was it distinct? And she said it was about 200 or 300 feet above the barn, and she got a very good look at it, and it was a very distinct, solid object. It was not hazy. It was not a blob of light. There was nothing shadowy about it. It was a structured craft hovering above her barn, and it had a circular shape. So that kind of answered my question. Now, that wasn't a very good investigation, but that's what I wanted to know.
Mm-hmm.
And from that point on, after I got out of high school and was into the Army, then I started doing some UFO research because the Army, as it moved me around the country, provided me with an opportunity to investigate some UFO sightings that I normally wouldn't have had a chance to investigate. But I wasn't doing it as part of my Army assignment. It was just I had an opportunity on the weekends to do these things, so I took that opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the names that you mentioned right at the beginning of your book, because you have such a well-designed chronological outline and storyline that you have throughout your book regarding events, recorded events, documented situations, you brought up a name that I hadn't heard in a long time, and that was Dorothy Kilgallen. And she was a very, very popular columnist, from what I understand. And you gave a date of May 22nd, 1955, and that she reported in an International News Service column that she had been told by a high-ranking official of the government of Britain that their scientists and airmen had examined one of the mysterious flying ships and that flying saucers originate on other planets. Now, Dorothy Kilgallen, from what I understand, was really quite a journalist. In fact, she ended up being murdered right after the JFK assassination, if I remember correctly. And she was doing some investigation, and she was eliminated. But the fascinating thing is that this woman didn't hesitate to go for the unique, the unknown, and talk about it. What called your attention to her report?
Because she talked about a recovery of a spacecraft, and that was the focus of the book. Is there have been recoveries of alien spacecraft, which means a crash of some kind. And it's interesting, we believe that the high British official who told her this was Lord Mountbatten.
Ah.
But we're not completely sure of what event they were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Because she didn't follow up on it, and there was no additional information. And it's important only because it was Dorothy Kilgallen who reported it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you were growing up in the 50s, you saw her on panel shows all the time. So she did a lot of television work. She was she did a lot of journalistic work. She was all over the place. So she was important. And it was interesting that she reported this story in the mid-1950s. And I think the date I assigned to that is simply the date that her article was published, but not necessarily the date of the crash. It could have been referring to something earlier. Well, obviously, we were referring to something earlier, but I think it may have been she was referring to the Roswell UFO crash case based on what we've been able to determine on that. So,
mm-hmm.
It's an important point that at the highest levels of the government, they're talking about this sort of thing, and they're talking about it quietly to one another. They're not really saying a lot to the general public or the journalistic community about it.
Let's start with your first recorded document, 840 AD. And you said that this is in Lyons, France, and you mentioned Bragg Steiger mentioning this particular event that occurred in 1840. What was the event? Where did it took place in France, but where were the records that this was found in?
There's a number of church records and old church records that people have translated through the years, and when we go back to something that far, we run into problems with interpretations.
Mm-hmm.
And Brad and I have talked about this a couple of times, and they were talking about these people from cloud ships, and that's been interpreted to mean ships that move through the clouds, or as we would call them today, airplanes. Of course, in 840 AD, there were no airplanes, so anything moving through the sky like that would clearly be of extraterrestrial origin. So the question is, you know, is the cloud, when you talk about cloud ships, are you talking about something that moves through the clouds? Are you talking about ships that have great big billowing sails on them that look like clouds? So they're referred to as cloud ships. So, you know, we run into problems with interpretation. And I thought this was important because we could explain that we'd run into those sorts of things. And it's an interesting story that's been documented and handed down through basically the millennia about these four creatures who were described as three men and one woman, and they were about to be killed by the people of France. And depending on the source you look at, they may have been stoned, they were going to be hanged, something like that, when a priest stepped in and stopped the executions. And so we have the story about these people who were dealing with the local population. These people may have been extraterrestrial. The descriptions in some of the stories suggest something that's a little alien-looking, not really completely human. Humanoid, of course, but not human. And so because of that strangeness, the people were frightened of them. And I mean, we can look at throughout history when two groups meet each other, they're frightened of one another because they don't know how they're going to be treated. But it's interesting because we have this priest stopping it, and we do have some documentation for the case. I follow that with another one that clearly, or at least to me, sounds like ball lightning. And I wanted to bring out, you know, this interpretation that you can have these sorts of events, and the people from 1,000 years ago weren't as sophisticated as we are because they weren't as familiar with the natural world as we are. So something that would be very frightening to them, like ball lightning, and I suppose if we were confronted with ball lightning today, we'd be pretty frightened by it too. But we understand what it is. We understand it's a natural phenomenon, where they didn't understand that. That was interpreted as it could be something alien or something spiritual, that sort of thing. So I wanted to look at these older cases because I wanted to talk a little bit about the interpretation of the writings and the descriptions we had in that time. I had looked at doing something with Ezekiel, who was the prophet, a Jewish prophet who had been captured and taken to Babylon. And of course, Ezekiel saw the wheel and describes what the wheel was and saw these strange beings from the wheel. But as I looked at that entire story, it may have preceded Ezekiel. It may have been an Egyptian story. Mm-hmm. There's all kinds of discussions of things like that. And I thought, well, this gets into a more religious and spiritual interpretation, and I really didn't want to go in that direction in this book. I wanted to look at things that I thought of more in the physical and material as opposed to the spiritual. So I kind of stayed away from Ezekiel and his wheel.
Let's jump forward to September of 1862 in the Indian Ocean. Now, this I found extremely interesting because it was the story of an old Danish sailor, and he in turn talked to a John Leander of El Campo, Texas, who wrote to the Houston Daily Post, and the story is just absolutely fascinating because this Danish sailor said that he had seen a strange aircraft as large as a battleship with four huge wings. It slams into a cliff. These sailors off their sailing ship, they go over to see if they can help anybody. They have no idea what this is. They investigate it, and they find implements and articles of furniture as well as food contained in metal boxes covered with strange characters. But what was even more fascinating is that the people they found, one, they were dressed in a manner they didn't ever expect to see, and they were very, very tall, had a dark bronze-toned skin, had beards, long hair that was very soft. I mean, this is a lot of detail.
Absolutely, but the thing you have to remember, it's kind of the friend of a friend story.
Mm-hmm.
It comes down to us because somebody told it to a reporter who put it down in the newspaper. So we have that kind of a documentation, but that, of course, doesn't mean the story is completely true. But it's an interesting story, as you say, because of the rich detail that is provided by the witnesses about what they saw, and it's a kind of a different perspective on life around us. The other thing you have to remember is we're now in the mid-1860s, or the, mm-hmm. the mid-1860s, and people are talking about the possibility of flight. During the Civil War, the Union used balloons to spy on the Confederates. They mm-hmm. would launch balloons, and George Custer, as a matter of fact, went up in the balloon so he could see the enemy emplacement, and they would know how to attack and where they were strong and that sort of thing. So aviation is being talked about, and it's not that much longer before we get into the great airship stories from 1897, but it's not that much further into the future when we actually develop powered flight. So that's the kind of thing people are talking about. So this story is interesting because it's kind of a precursor of the things that we would hear about in the modern UFO phenomena, mm-hmm. as we talked about crashes. So it's interesting in that respect. But we always have to remember it's kind of a friend story, and it's interesting, but we really don't have good corroboration for it.
One of the things he said is that as proof, he had this huge metal ring, and nobody could determine what the metal was. Like that's what he walked away from the site with. But in Nebraska, in 1884, there was a crash site. And it was written up in the Nebraska Nugget on June the 8th. And it happened in the afternoon. Tell us about John Ellis and what happened there. It almost seems so similar to the Roswell situation that happened many years later.
And we have a number of cowboys who ride over a hill and see this thing that's crashed. They can't get close to it because it's way too hot for them. They have to wait for it to cool off. And then they go, when it finally cools off, they can go pick up some little pieces of debris. And as you mentioned, it's written up in the newspaper, and there's a number of newspaper articles about what they saw and what they did. Now, Jerry Clark, who's a well-known UFO researcher, and a number of others did some research into this story quite a number of years ago, and their opinion is this story is more of a tale told by cowboys around the campfire that doesn't have a whole lot of validity to it. But these sorts of stories are interesting because they're precursors to what we see when we get into the modern era. And you do the parallel yourself that here is something where we've got a crash site, we've got the cowboys going out there, they pick up the debris and that sort of thing. And it kind of is reminiscent of the Roswell case, but we don't have the government intervention into this case like we do into the Roswell case. So it's interesting in that, and once again, we're in that period where we're about to make our first trips into the atmosphere. Their balloons are being flown now. The first balloon flight, by the way, was in the 18th century in France, but it's like 1764 or something. So balloons are well known, and people have been able to make balloon ascensions. But now we're beginning to talk about airships, great airships, which
mm-hmm.
I think culminated in the Hindenburg. But I mean that sort of thing, and people are beginning to talk about that. Scientific American is. Speculating in that direction. This is where travel is going to go. It's going to move from the surface of the planet to the atmosphere as we move around. So these stories are very interesting as they suggest where science is in that time frame and what people are thinking about.
Let's pop over to Missouri. It's Cape Girardeau.
Girardeau,
thank you
Cape
for
Girardeau.
Correcting me. Cape Girardeau. Now, this is interesting because of the time frame, 1941.
Yes.
And let's talk about that story for a bit.
Once again, we're dealing with a family member who's heard this story, a tradition from her family. And according to Charlotte Mann, her grandfather, who was a Baptist minister, was called out one night, and we believe it was April of 1941, based on what she can remember of this. He goes out to a point outside of town where some kind of bizarre crash has crashed, and there's a number of injured or dead pilots from it. They're not human pilots, clearly, because they're smaller than humans. They're thinner than humans. And he wasn't sure whether they were dressed in kind of a metallic wrinkled clothing or if that was basically their skin. He couldn't really tell. But he's there to kind of give them last rites. And it seems that one of them was alive when he first got there and died shortly thereafter. So he's taken out there by the sheriff, and he's out there with the state police. He's out there with some military people, and once he's completed his mission, which is basically to pray for these poor unfortunates, he's taken home and told not to talk about it. Well, naturally, he tells the family where he's been and what he's done.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of weeks later, somebody brings him a photograph of the alien creatures, which unfortunately has been lost because. Had it not been lost, we could have a whole different discussion. But Charlotte Mann can describe it. Now, we have other members of the family saying, yes, we remember our grandfather talking about this. There's a brother of the sheriff who says he remembers his brother who talking about this. So we have some corroboration for it. Now, there are people who have looked through the newspapers and everything from that era in that area to find out if they could find anything like that in the newspaper suggesting of this kind of a story, but they really couldn't. I'm always bothered by this story because it seems to me, had this been extraterrestrial, then the reaction at Roswell some 6 years later should have been different. Somebody should have been expecting something else to happen, and it seems at Roswell they were caught completely flat-footed. It could be that the people who made the initial decisions at Roswell clearly weren't aware of Cape Girardeau, and once it got off the chain, other decisions were made because of what had happened at Cape Girardeau. But this is an interesting case because it precedes Roswell. There are a number of different witnesses to it, and there are things that we can check. There are investigations that we can make. Were there some unusual military activity in the area? And according to the newspapers, yeah, there was a little bit. But we're also right at the time where World War II is about to break out, and I think in 1941, everybody expected the United States to get into it, and I know that President Roosevelt had called up the National Guard prior to this event. And one of the things you see in the National Guard history is the a unit of the Oklahoma National Guard being called up in 1941 for a year, and 5 years later they finally get to go home. They're finally released from active duty. So the National Guard figures prominently in World War II, of course. But the point is, so are there troop movements and things going on through Cape Girardeau. And so that a military retrieval in that area could be masked by some of these troop movements. And the newspapers do talk about some of these things, and a couple of them where there were no announcements that the troops would be coming in. They just kind of showed up. And so that's kind of an intriguing prospect to the story as well.
Roswell is a story that is talked about. I mean, I don't know how many television serials have been made about it. There's just been all kinds of conversation because of the fact that there was actual material recovered and there were those individuals that testified, and you go into that into your book. But at the same time, about the same time, and this was July 5th of 1947, the plains of San Augustin had a particular happening that paralleled Roswell, and it's interesting.
Well, according to Stan Friedman, it's part of the same event. Stan believes that two objects collided. One came down near Roswell, and the reason we know all about that one is because there were so many witnesses to
mm-hmm.
it. We look at Colonel Blanchard being the commanding officer at Roswell, at his primary staff, and every member of the staff that we talked to that we could find, with one exception, said it was extraterrestrial. So Roswell is pretty well established as something extraordinary. Now, Stan believes that there was a second crash over on the plains of San Augustine, and this is based on the testimony of a fellow named Barney Barnett. And Barnett was a soil conservation engineer who lived in Socorro. And according to what he told family and friends, he had been out in what he called the high country, which is out toward the plains of San Augustine. Plains of San Augustine is a dried-up ancient lake bed, so it's kind of an interesting location. And he saw something glinting off the road, went over to it, and came to a crashed object with, I believe he said, four bodies around it with pear-shaped heads and very, very skinny. And that a group of archaeologists appeared not long after that, and the military showed up and chased them all off or escorted them out of the area. The only problem with the Barney Barnett tale is that Ruth Barnett, Barney's wife, kept a diary for 1947, and it's apparently the only year she kept a diary because somebody had given her a daily reminder book, and she used it every day. She religiously filled out what had happened that day, and boy, some of it is really incredibly boring. But, I mean, you know, we know where she went and what was going on and how hot it was and what they bought at the store and what they had for supper and all that sort of thing. But when we get to the July of 1947, there's no mention of any kind of event there, which is very problematical. I believe that the Barney Barnett story is probably not related to Roswell. Stan believes it is. So there is a bit of controversy between Stan Friedman and me on that specific aspect of it. There was a fellow who came out in after the Unsolved Mysteries program, and you talk about the all the Roswell stories. That was one of the very first of the Roswell stories on Unsolved Mysteries in 1989, and both Stan and I were on that program, and one of the people who wrote in or called in to the hotline there was a fellow named Gerald Anderson, who said that he had been involved in this event in 1947. Stan and I disagree. I don't believe Gerald Anderson was telling the truth. Stan believes he was. So what I try to do in the book is, here's all the information. Here's what I think happened. Here's what I believe about this aspect of it. And Gerald goes into great detail about a dome disc and what he saw and the aliens, I think he eventually said two were dead. One was very badly injured and died shortly thereafter, and one was in fairly good shape, giving aid to his fellows. And the military showed up and escorted them off the field and told them not to talk about this. Gerald Anderson presented a diary that was supposedly written by a family member from the time frame. The ink didn't match. It was from 1974, so it didn't match. So there were some problems with the story. But the Barnett story, in the beginning, brought the alien aspect to the Roswell case, because in the very beginning there weren't any real tales of bodies being picked up or found at the Roswell site. Since that time, other witnesses have been found who do bring in alien bodies to the Roswell case. But in the very beginning, it was the Barney Barnett story that linked or brought in alien creatures. So it's important because of that.
Let's move forward to 2000, and you have stories about events in Africa. And the thing is that when these things happen, as we know, if anything is falling from a high altitude, it builds up such speed that it creates its own heat, and depending on what it is made of, it can burn itself up before it gets to the ground. Or it'll explode if it's got any kind of materials in it that would cause that. And there was some kind of sphere that fell into a vineyard about 40 miles from Cape Town. And they said it was too hot to touch for 30 minutes. It was made of solid iron and had some bolts on it. And there were witnesses to this. Now, it's an unidentifiable flying object. That really suits it. It is a UFO. But there were some other things about this. It's fascinating how to really get the facts of what really occurred. I mean, reality sometimes is more elusive than science fiction stories. It's just absolutely amazing. Tell us about this and what happened to it?
There are a number of stories out of South Africa in that time frame where they've seen something happen, and these stories come from the South African News Service. And you pretty well covered the whole thing. They find something as you're moving through the atmosphere. If you look at a meteor, most people will tell you. Most of the people who study meteors tell you that when they get to the ground, they're pretty well cooled off. They kind of burn up and they begin to coast to the ground. And as they get into the lower atmosphere, they cool off. But when you get an object that is hot, that suggests it's not meteoric in origin. And they pick up these things. I lean to the idea that these are some kind of natural phenomena, or maybe something that's broken off of something that we created and sent into space. But we don't know. The Air Force had a project that we know was called Project Moondust back in 1985 when the name was compromised and they changed the name. And Project Moondust, its purpose was to look at things like this, to go to places where they had found returning space debris, either of a foreign manufacturer or unknown origin. And, of course, unknown origin takes us into the realm of the UFOs. And so this would be the kind of thing that Project Moondust would be interested in. But I don't know of anything that suggests that the this was Project Moondust in any way, shape, or form. So we do have this. The woman talked to the police. It was something that was about 70 pounds in weight, and that it had been on fire when it fell out of the sky. And not long after that, there was a second event where there was a heavier object that weighed about 200 pounds that fell not all that far from where she was. And all this was taken to Pretoria for analysis, and then they asked NASA to take a look at it. And this is where we end up with Project Moondust being involved, or whatever the name is that they use now for it. So we've got something that has been seen falling out of the sky. It's an object of unknown origin. There's two very large pieces of this thing, whatever it was, and that we know that the United States was involved because the South Africans asked for our assistance. But once we get to that point, that's all the information we have. Nothing else can be found. And FOIA requests for additional information are the normal answer is, well, we have nothing responsive to your request, and that's the end of it, unless you want to get into a big lawsuits and that sort of thing with the government, which I try to avoid at all costs because they usually don't work out very well. Pardon me?
Yes, they don't. Yes,
they
don't
work out real well.
That's right, they don't. Kevin, we're out of time. It's been a delight having you as a guest. Your stories are intriguing. Your presentation is very thoughtful, and I think it gives pause and cause to think about what it is we expect. Is it fantasy? Is it reality? Well, you've done a good job of documenting a history of famous incidents, conspiracies, and cover-ups. Kevin Randall, give me your blog quickly because we have to go on break now. What is your blog?
It's Kevin Randall. It's randle.blogspot.com. But if that is too complicated, just type a different perspective into your search engine and put UFO after it, and it should take you right to it.
Great. All right. This is Donna Sebo again. Kevin, thank you for being my guest. Kevin Randall, a crash when UFOs fall from the sky. This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. We'll be back in just a moment.
Do you have a group, organization, or club that would like to have an interesting and dynamic speaker? Then you're going to want to have Donna speak to your group. She motivates audiences towards personal empowerment, giving them tools for their personal and professional success. If you would like Donna Sebo to bring a presentation to your next event, call Delphi International at 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
Welcome, my lords and ladies, to the Washington Midsummer Renaissance Fair, located at Marist Farms in Buckley, Washington. For 3 weekends in August, starting August 7th and 8th, we will transport you back to the days of old, where magic and merriment reign. Come see the multitude of musicians, dancers, jugglers, gypsies, peasants, nobles, pirates, and prestidigitation. That's magic for you commoners. Learn to swing a sword or shoot a bow and be knighted by Her Majesty the Queen. hold your breath as jousters wheel their mounts around to engage in full contact combat on the field of battle. Sign on to sail the seas with Scurvy Pirates, or sit down with friends and family for turkey legs and a fine brewed ale. Delights abound for the young and old at the Washington Midsummer Renaissance Fair, so come one and all, starting August 7th and 8th, for fun and excitement, and may your day be fair. For tickets and info, go to www.washingtonfair.com.
Hello, and this is Donna Sebo. Telephone lines are now open. The number to call if you'd like to chat with me is 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756. Now, I did want to let you know that this Saturday, by the way, if you want to call me, that's fine. All I need is from you is your first name or your initial. And, of course, I love to know where you're calling in from. And then I'll be happy to answer a question for you. This Saturday, I'm going to be doing a show in Spring Hill, Tennessee, with Teresa Hanna. And that's going to be at 10 o'clock Pacific time. And it's called In the Spotlight. And it's going to be on WMRB, 910 AM. And we're going to be having a conversation that day. So if you would like to call in, that's this Saturday. I don't know the call-in number or if that is going to be possible, but you will be able to listen to Teresa and me have a conversation. We'll be chatting about all kinds of things. So I told you I'd let you know when the next show was coming up that was going to be on air. And this one, again, is in Spring Hill, Tennessee. And, of course, you can go to my website and check on the newsletter, and you'll find a listing of all the different shows that I have been scheduled to do so that if you wanted to listen to them, you'd be able to do so. Again, 888-815-9756. Now, we just played the ad for the Washington Midsummer Renaissance Fair. Well, I have some free tickets. Now, I know that it's only the people in Washington that are going to be able to take advantage of this unless you're out of state and you're planning on coming in and visiting in the Seattle area. We'd love to have you. I have 8 free passes. These are family passes, and I would be delighted to send one to you. But you need to either call me or send me an email. And in the email, you need to say Donna Free Tickets or Donna Ticket for the Renaissance Fair. And then send in your email, your contact information, so I can pop this free pass to you in the mail. If you want to call me, the telephone number to call is 800-872-8852. It's 3 weeks away when it begins. It's the first 3 weekends in August. And this is an event I've been participating in for about 10 years now, and I just think it is fabulous. It is wonderful family entertainment. It's imaginative. It just enables you to take a break from what I call the techie world and enter into a time frame and a space that's full of fun, imagination, and the kids just absolutely love it. Of course, I think all the adults that go there are just reverting back to their childhood anyway. They just have just as much fun as the kids do. So I invite you, if you're in the state of Washington and you would like to have a free pass, this is held at the Maris Farms in Buckley, again, August 7th, 8th, 14, 15, 21st, and 22nd. It's a family day pass, 2 adults and 2 children. That's what's going to be available to you. So call me or email me. That's terrific. Eliza Day wrote a poem, and boy, I can relate to this because the rose gardens in our neighborhood are absolutely blooming with all their heart. And she wrote this little poem saying, red roses, summer art on a picket fence, climb the way skyward, sharing trade secrets with one another. And we have a neighbor, that's exactly the way it is. The rose bush, it's a climbing rose bush, is so full of blooms, it's got literally hundreds on it. And this is a bush that has grown through the years and keeps becoming bigger and bigger and bigger. And it's just so much fun to see all of this. It's just such a delight. Then I came across something that I thought was really cute. It's a young woman sitting across from her date, and she's looking at him, and she said, I agreed to have dinner with you. I accidentally hit reply to all on the email. Long story short, I'm now dating 112 people. I mean, I've had enough experiences with pushing the wrong button on the computer. But 112 dates? Woo! That's a big one. Donna Sebo here. Give me a call if you'd like to chat. 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756 if you'd like to chat with me. I also wanted to go back, and I wasn't able to finish my story about a very fine man named Meb. He is from Africa, and for those of you that weren't listening to the show yesterday, I will just begin because I had only gotten through about a third of it, and we ran out of time. But his story is so significant. His story is the story of millions of people who have come to the United States because it represented the right of choice. It represented freedom, and the world they were living in was anything but that. Now, Meb's dad had been a freedom fighter in the war against Ethiopia, and they were living in Eritrea. And when Meb was 5 years old, his dad had to leave the country. His life was in danger, and the family had to be left behind. The father was just absolutely stressed, and he ended up, after spending 2 years in the Sudan, which was quite a place in upheaval, he settled in Italy, managed to find work, and for 5 years the family's connection was only through the letters and gifts that he managed to send them. And whenever his dad would go out shopping, he had no way of knowing the measurements of his children's feet, of the clothing that they would wear, but he always picked whatever he thought might be appropriate, and of course, much of the time, the items didn't fit. His father saved enough money, but his father was determined that Italy was not going to be their home. His destination for his family was the United States. Why? Because, as I mentioned earlier, it represented freedom and opportunity, the right of choice. And he would communicate to his family, people can go to school there, they can get an education, and you have the opportunity to be whatever you want to be. Well, Meb was 12 years old when he and the rest of his family finally arrived in San Diego, California. It was in October of 1987. He said a new sister had come into the family while they were living in Italy. In total, they were a family of nine. And he said, we were all in this little tiny apartment. No transportation. We couldn't have a car. And he said, we walked everywhere. We had found out about fast food. There were high-rise buildings. And then he said, my brothers and I discovered that there was a park nearby where we were living. And they were all these kids out there playing soccer. And he said, we thought they were nuts. Why were these kids running all over the grass? It just didn't make any sense. Well, he found out that there were kids, not only were they playing soccer, but they also were preparing for a national high school cross-country championship. But he just said, this was all so strange to me. It just didn't seem logical. Well, you can imagine coming from an environment where that just wasn't a part of it. Now, his father had an attitude about education. He demanded that his children be the best that they could be. And his dad set a very high bar for them. He wanted them to get A's. He would wake his kids up at 4:30 in the morning to study because that was the only time he could help them before he went to work. And he worked at night. He cleaned offices. And then during the day, this father drove a taxi cab to support his family. So nobody ever argued with her dad. Nobody ever did. They just got up and they would work from 4:30 until 6:45 and then they got ready to go off to school. And he would tell them frequently he had not been able to continue his education because it wasn't permitted in his country and he wanted his kids to have it better than he did. Well, I'm going to tell you the rest of the story after we come back from break because it is a powerful story of how one man attained a goal that never would have been possible if he hadn't been in this country. We're going to take a break. We'll be back in just a moment.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature, however, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Enter the magical world of God's kiss.
He sees a large open area of valley ground covered with a thick green grass. In the open space are many other children and animals. All kinds of animals. And all of the animals are talking. He can understand every word they are saying.
God's Kiss is a beautifully illustrated children's book about a young boy's journey into a valley with children and animals from all over the world. They are gathering together to experience the wonder of love and beauty that will affect their lives forever. A talking book audio narrated by the author Donna Sebo accompanies this wonderful storybook, creating a special magic all of its own. This book package makes a wonderful gift for those special children in your life, ages 3 to 10. God's Kiss book and talking book audio are only $19.95 plus shipping and handling. And the author Donna Sebo will autograph and personalize your book if you request it. Call 800-872-8852. You can also order through Donna Sebo's website, www.DelphiInternational.com.
Hello, this is Donna. And I want to let you know tomorrow's guest is going to be Barry Weiner. We're going to be talking about one of New York's finest. That's a New York police officer. His father, in fact. Barry made the plan to publish his father's writings after he passed away, and that's what CYA is going to be all about. So I hope you'll join me tomorrow. We're going to be talking with him in New York City about a man who obviously had a tremendous impact on his life, but also left the legacy of the New York Police Department and his personal experience in story. So he'll be my guest tomorrow. I wanted to finish my story about Meb, who came out of Africa. As I told you, his father would get him up, he and the rest of the kids. They all had to get up and would have to study. Now, when Meb was in the seventh grade, he said there were races in his gym class. Well, that's not unusual. But one day the teacher said, today we're going to do a full mile. I want you to do the very best you can. And I'll give you an A or B, but if you mess around, you're going to get a D. So the teacher was really serious about this. Now, Meb had never, ever run a mile before. He didn't have a clue. All he knew is that he had to get an A because that was his father's standard. So he ran as hard and as fast as he could. Well, the teacher used the stopwatch and was absolutely blown away because without any practical training or anything like that, Meb ran a 5-minute, 20-second mile. And he called the coach at the school and said, we've got a future Olympian here. This is a seventh grader, and this is how fast he ran. Well, this was had not even been in Meb's psyche. This was the last thing in the world that he would have ever imagined he would be a part of. He ended up joining the cross-country and track teams. He won races, one right after another. In his senior year, He was one of the kids running at the park in the high school championship, just like he had seen when he first came into the area of San Diego. He was out there doing that very same thing that he and his brothers thought were so silly when he was a senior. Now, there was a coach whose name was Bob Larson. He was the track and field and cross-country coach at UCLA. He gave Meb a full scholarship. In fact, he's still Meb's coach at the track club. And under that scholarship, Meb won 4 NCAA titles, and he did fabulously in college as well, and he received his diploma in 1998. And he also became a citizen in that year, and he said, I really found that what my father said, that in America his education would take him where he needed to go, even when his legs no longer could. Now, there was a friend that had trained with him. His name was Ryan. And they just trained together regularly. And there was real sad news that occurred. Ryan dropped dead of a heart attack. And this was really a trauma because there was no indication that Ryan was in any way physically handicapped by a condition, but it happened. Well, there was another thing that started hitting Meb. He was going to be in a major race. Actually, it was in New York, and he found that he couldn't run. In fact, he actually collapsed. He thought he was going to retire, and he said it was very heartbreaking to him because he loved the running. However, his hips gave out on him. He actually wore out his hips. Well, he ended up going in and having surgery. They found out that there was a stress fracture. It was very, very severe. However, he had to take, they said, we can take care of this, but you're going to have a year of rehab, and you're also going to have physical therapy. Well, by golly, he decided to run the New York City Marathon in, well, let's see, what year was it? I think it was 2009. And no American had won this race since Alberto Salazar in 1982. But Meb did. He said, I am a man who was born in a tiny village halfway across the world. A man who did not make his journey alone. I had a fabulous family. I had good friends that trained with me. I said, I have a wonderful wife. And I have a wonderful family of my own. And he said, in November of 2009, in the New York Marathon, I turned into Central Park with 2 miles to go and pulled away from my closest competitor. And on my home stretch, I passed the spot where my friend Ryan had fallen so many years before. And then I crossed the finish line first. His story is a powerful one, and one that I think we need to tuck away in our brains. Not that we're necessarily going to be a marathon runner, but it's that life happens sometimes. And you have to have that attitude of preparation, that preparedness that says, I'm going to give the very best I've got. If I don't have a perfect shot at something, okay, but I'm going to give it my best regardless. And when you do that, you are going to cross your own finish line in your own way so that you can reach for something even better than you could have ever conceived. Meb had no idea that his life would give him the opportunities or the challenges that he had. But he made sure he didn't give up. He kept working at something until he was actually able to achieve his goal. And it didn't happen overnight. This is Donna Sebo. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. I'll talk with you tomorrow, same time, same place, right here on bbsradio.com. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.
Hello, this is Wesley Snipes, and when I want to get tuned in, tuned up, and not tuned out, I listen to Dr. Fred Bell, Health and Sciences Show on BBSRadio.com. Mary had a little lamb.